Have you ever wondered what Manhattan looked like before the Dutch started changing it? What it looked like in 1609 when Henry Hudson first sailed along the island's shoreline? Through the use of historical maps, ecological data, new technologies, and years of primary research, Eric Sanderson has been able to reconstruct not only what the island looked like, but also the kinds of plants and animals that inhabited it 400 years ago. His book, called Manahatta, A Natural History of New York City, is published by Abrams. It's also the basis for a new exhibit by the same name that opens tomorrow at the Museum of the City of New York. Mr. Sanderson is Senior Conservation Ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
You write that if Manhattan existed today as it did then, it would be a national park. It would be the crowning glory of American national parks. Just how ecologically diverse was the island around the time Henry Hudson arrived in 1609?
Well, it turns out because of where Manahatta exists in its biogeography at the edge of the last glaciation on the Atlantic Flyway for birds, it gets the Gulf Stream waters during the summer and it gets the Hudson River and the tidal estuary, that it was really diverse in terms of its ecological communities. Over 55 different ecosystem types once existed on Manhattan or in the surrounding waters of the island.
And what would it have looked like to Henry Hudson? Would it have been mostly wooded as he sailed up the Hudson? Or would he have thought of it as marshlands? Would he have seen a lot of streams?
He would have seen a long, narrow, wooded island with tidal wetlands along the edges. He came up the Hudson River, and there was sandy beaches on the Hudson River shore from nearly the Battery up to 42nd Street.
A lot of oysters.
That's right. That's right. Oyster Bay around Oyster Island, which is our Liberty Island. Maybe porpoises and striped bass in the harbor. Perhaps sea turtles come in September sometimes, maybe even whales. Some of the early maps have whales. In fact, in the original charter for Trinity Church in 1705, they had the right to collect any whales that beached on the beach right beside the church and use those as part of the proceeds for the church.
Was the climate pretty much the same as it is today?
That's right. Maybe a little bit cooler. We have long-term tree ring records that show the ratio of severe droughts to wet years, and we're still more or less in that same kind of bracket of climate, although it's changed, and certainly the temperature's gone up over the last 100 years.
And you also say that it was a major bird migratory spot.
That's right. Maybe 350 birds would have been on Manhattan in September of 1609 when Henry Hudson arrived. Many of the migratory birds coming through on the fall migration.
And we still get a few, but not the same as we did then.
Well, actually, New York's still great for its bird watching. Central Park, in particular, because you imagine you're a little bird flying south on the fall migration, and you come over this rocky, stony city, and then you see this green Central Park, and you think, that's the mana, that's the heaven that I want.
The reason I asked about climate, I was thinking about the differences that occur just simply when you knock down an awful lot of trees and dam up streams, and you put down a lot of concrete and put a lot of buildings on top of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we have this urban heat island effect today that's because these buildings absorb so much heat, and that wouldn't have been true in the past, and the trees would have been transpiring. There were 66 miles of streams, maybe 300 springs on the island. You know, New York's very fortunate because it has a very kind of even precipitation, more or less 4 inches of rain and snowfall month in and month out during the course of the year.
You write that there were 55 different kinds of ecological communities on the island, the size of only 20 square miles. How does that level of diversity compare to a rainforest or a coral reef of similar size?
Right, right. Well, ecologists talk about beta biodiversity, which is the diversity of ecological communities, which underlies species diversity or the kind of biodiversity we normally talk about. And Manahatta had more communities per acre than your average rainforest, your average coral reef.
Which Why?
Meant, why?
Because it's an island, isn't it? Wasn't it hard to get to?
No, not particularly. You know, it's Bitendival Creek, which is between the Bronx and Manhattan. You know, large animals could come across. It has to do with the long-term history. You know, the glaciers came down. You know, different communities form south of where the glaciers were, places that were never under ice, and other communities form just north of that. And so it turns out the glaciers, came down, left the moraine across Long Island, Staten Island, which, meant that Manhattan was right on the edge of that.
Well, would it have been similar in the surrounding areas, or was Manhattan particularly welcoming to these species?
Well,
bears, what, mink, otters?
Yeah.
Orchid.
Black
orchids.
Bears. Yeah, and 30 different species of orchids, 70 different kinds of trees, 350 kinds of birds, like we talked about. You know, Manhattan would have been like most of the rest of the city that's in this coastal tidal estuary environment that would have been very, very abundant and very robust. As you moved inland from here into New Jersey or up north into New York State, the diversity would have dropped because there wouldn't have been so many different kinds of communities.
We're talking about these days about the growing number of extinct species. Do we have any idea of how many of the species that existed here in 1609 are no longer with us?
Well, it's actually a really interesting story, and it depends a lot on the different kind of plant or animal you're talking about. Probably the plant diversity is twice now what it was 400 years ago because of introductions. Just like New York's been a place where immigrants, human immigrants have come, you know, biological immigrants have come through New York and through the harbor. In terms of the birds, we have three species that were here before that aren't here now, the passenger pigeon, the Eskimo curlew, and the heath hen. The heath hen's a grassland bird that used to live in the grasslands of Harlem, and they were maintained by Native American fire.
And we know because of eyewitness reports or because we have a fossil record?
Well, several lines of evidence. We know that the Harlem Plains were a grassland because there's a Dutch record from 1624 talking about a large grassy place on the east side of Manhattan where you could grow crops without having to cut down any trees, and subsequent accounts of a plain in the grassland that's described.
The Indians created those plains, didn't they?
Yeah.
Through fires.
According to our research, that's right. The hypothesis is that that Native Americans lit fires probably for hunting purposes in Harlem, and by doing that frequently enough, we were able to establish that if they lit fires once every 10 years or more, that would transform that landscape into a grassland.
So a lot of this stuff is through extrapolation.
Through inference, that's right.
Because if you find a certain animal in an area, you would assume that the related animals, the animals that it, or plants that it lives on, would also be there?
Well, it actually kind of works more the other way around, that we started with a very detailed map of the original landscape that told us where the shoreline was and the streams and the wetlands and the topography. And then we built up from that landscape to say what the different kind of ecosystem types were. And then from those, connected those habitat relationships for all the species.
We have a slideshow of images from Manhattan on our website, and you've developed a website that shows viewers what their block looked like 400 years ago. We have a link to that as well at WMIC.org. What would our current location at 160 Varick Street have been like back then?
Yeah, well, I looked it up this morning before I came in, and it was a coastal oak hickory forest, a little bit of oak tulip tree forest, so we would have been a forest here. And the topography in this part of Manhattan was sort of a rolling topography of hills and valleys, and there were a few streams that came through here. So if you go to our website, you can actually zoom into a particular block, double-click on that block, and get a list of all the plants and animals that we think lived in that block, find out what the Native Americans were doing, what they were hunting and what they were gathering, what they were fishing, and also basic characteristics about the landscape, and also go through and see modern geographic data about open space and environmental resources related to where you live.
Would this have been very different than the top of the island, Inwood?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Inwood is there was a major Lenape settlement up in northern Manhattan called Shore-Capac, right along the edge of where Inwood Park and Isham Park is today. And so the Lenape, they affected the landscape just like people everywhere have. They grew crops. They would burn down a little bit of the forest and plant these gardens of three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, that rely on each other in order to produce their food. They also lit fires, like we talked about, to clear the trails. And so you would have seen forest types up there, but more affected by what people were doing than what you would have seen down here.
Well, right now, Manhattan is one of the more densely populated areas of the world. What was it like back then? How many Lenape were there?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say for sure, but several lines of evidence suggest somewhere in the sort of 300 to 600 people range for Manhattan over the course of a year. The Lenape had this sort of itinerant lifestyle where they live in one place during the fish runs and another place when it was right time to grow crops. So you know, for your listeners, if they're walking in Midtown and they see a full block, that block might be everybody who lived on Manhattan 400 years ago.
But the island could have supported a lot more people because it was so diverse. I'm surprised that if it was a place that so many animals wanted to live, that more humans didn't want to live here.
Well, you know, if you live a hunting-gathering sort of culture, there's a baseline level of density that kind of lifestyle can support, and that's about what Manhattan supported 400 years ago.
Bobby from the East Village left a question on our show page. He said on the 1609 map that's been created, what do the light yellow green areas indicate? For example, the East Village east of Avenue B and the east side north of 110th Street.
Right. So you're seeing, you know, in this forest canopy, you're seeing subtle gradations of green, which represent different forest types. But then you're also seeing openings that are related to wetlands. There were several kinds of swamps and marshes on the island. You're seeing salt marshes down by the shore. And in some places, you're also seeing openings that were created by Native Americans through their use of fire.
Now, the Dutch built up the bottom of the island. They had a large island at their disposal, and yet they expanded the shape of Lower Manhattan with landfill. Why would they do that?
Well, you know, for a long time, Manhattan just had a little tiny town on it. And some people think that the Dutch were particularly attracted to Lower Manhattan, not only because of its place for navigation and defense, but also because it was low rolling topography with tidal wetlands, not unlike what they would have found back in Holland where they came from. As you moved up the island, it got rockier and more mountainous. I mean, we're not talking about huge rocky mountains, but we're talking about, you know, 100 feet, 200 feet, denser forests, thicker forests, and also more Native Americans. Like we said before, the Native Americans uptown was kind of their downtown.
Central Park, which is our largest natural area, is all man-made. Did we create something that was similar to what we had destroyed when we rebuilt it?
Well, you know, I think there's actually a lot of myths about Central Park. On the one hand, you know, some people say it's all man-made, and certainly there was a plan that they was created. But on the other hand, that plan retained some of the original topography. And so when you see some of the big rock outcrops like Umpire Rock, well, you know, back in the 19th century, they didn't have the capacity to pick up Umpire Rock and say, I want it over 10 feet and up a little bit because that's what my design says to do. So what happened is they could blow things up and they could take stuff away, but they couldn't actually move things around. So in that sense, you know, there are features of Central Park that are what it was like 400 years ago. On the other hand, you know, Central Park is affected by, you know, all the people that love it and come to visit there every year.
My guest is Eric Sanderson, senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and author of Manahatta, A Natural History of New York City, which is published by Abrams. And Manahatta means Island of Many Hills?
That's right, Island of Many Hills.
So that means a lot of hills were leveled.
That's right, especially in the lower part of the island. As sort of the city grid that was adopted in 1807 was implemented, they basically leveled the hills. There was a hill not very far from here, Richmond Hill, and there was a very fancy house up on the top of it that Aaron Burr lived in and John Adams lived in, and they wanted to retain that house, and so they actually put it up, they sort of lifted it up and then took away the hill underneath it until the hill was down, reduced to the regular ground level.
Should I assume that Murray Hill was a hill?
Murray Hill was a hill, and in fact, on this British headquarters map that we use from the American Revolution, you can actually see the Murray's house on Murray Hill.
The hills have an impact on the flow of watersheds. Where did the streams that ran around Murray Hill drain into?
Right. So there were two large stream networks on either side of Murray Hill that were draining from the west side and then came down and around Murray Hill and into the east side near Turtle Bay and Kipps Bay today, which were originally bays. Turtle Bay probably might have had turtles there, but it was also shaped like a turtle, which maybe where the name comes from.
Where did the name Minetta Lane come from, or Minetta Street? Because that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, no, Minetta Water was a stream that ran through Greenwich Village, kind of along down the line of Fifth Avenue and through Washington Square Park. And then Minetta Street was the path alongside the stream, and Minetta Lane was the bridge that went across the stream.
So did Greenwich Village grow up because it had this waterway?
Greenwich Village grew up because it had good farming land. So the if you read the early Dutch records, they talk about the Native Americans who were planting tobacco on the rich soils around Minetta Water, and so that's why it eventually developed the way it did.
Well, what happened to all of those streams?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. The you know, streams are fed by the rain and by the snow, and so in our modern city, we catch the rain and the snow, and we try and get rid of it as fast as possible through our storm drains. So in some sense, our storm drains are our new streams. But it's also true that often when I'm giving talks about the project, people say to me, you know, there's my basement always floods. Was there a stream under my basement? And so
sometimes on the subway, we see water leaking through the walls.
That's right. And they say that, you know, if the subway pumps stopped pumping, the subways would very rapidly fill with water. And that's because when the glaciers left, they left these beds of sand and silt. The water still likes to run through. So when you see water coming into your basement, it could be from, you know, a leak in the storm drain system or a leak in the pavement or from a park that's feeding the groundwater. But it could equally be from a water main break, and that's water coming out of the Catskill, Delaware water system.
You write of another watershed, the Collect Pond. It was one of the most important natural features of Lower Manhattan.
Yeah, well, you can't drink the water of the Hudson River or the East River here. It's too salty. And so when the Native Americans were here and then when the Dutch and the British colonists came afterwards, they needed to find fresh water, and they found it on Manhattan Island. There was a pond about where Foley Square is today, just north of City Hall, called the Collect Pond, which was the fresh water source for New York City for its first 200 years. It was 80 feet deep, fed by underwater springs, actually renowned for its fishing, so much so that the city council in the 1730s adopted a regulation saying you couldn't fish with nets anymore, only hook and line in the collect pond.
And now there are courthouses over there?
That's right.
And a prison.
Shortly after the American Revolution, in an act of poor city planning, the city fathers let some leather tanneries set up shop on the edge of the collect pond, and tanneries produce all kinds of nasty chemicals that they just dumped in the water, which was standard practice back then, but that meant that nobody could drink the water within about a decade.
This is very close to Canal Street. Is there a connection?
There is a connection, yeah. So they realized the collect pond wasn't any good anymore, and it was standing in the way of the city, so there was a hill next to it, the Caltrook, so they knocked that hill into the pond and then dug a canal to drain the water that normally would have gone into the collect pond, and that canal gives its name to Canal Street. And this whole neighborhood became a very, very poor and difficult neighborhood to live in. The land actually started to subside because they hadn't filled it correctly, and so the buildings would actually sink into the mud, and it really started to stink because of all the buried vegetation, and so only the very new poor immigrants could live there. And
that was the Four Corners?
It became the Five Points neighborhood. Right. If you actually overlay the Five Points, which we don't have those streets anymore either, but on top of the British headquarters map, you can see that they are right on top of the collect pond.
Even though human development destroyed many of the ecosystems on the island, you write that extraordinary cultural diversity has replaced extraordinary biodiversity on the island. So in some sense, Manhattan is still the same kind of place?
Well, interestingly, and certainly interesting for me as an ecologist who came to New York City to work on wildlife conservation all over the world in the wild places of the world, if you think about the factors that make ecosystems work, the things like density and diversity and interdependence and that provides habitat for all these different kind of creatures, and in fact, those are the same principles that make cities work. You have to sort of change the characters a little bit, but you can just change the words and talk about cities in the same terms practically as ecosystems, and it works out.
Well, can we say that Manhattan is still ecologically diverse?
It certainly is culturally diverse. In the exhibition, we actually have a graphic where we show the land use in 1609, 1782, and today in 2009 in the 21st century. And you know, half the city now is dedicated to streets and sidewalks, which is more or less one kind of ecosystem as far as other critters are concerned.
We were talking earlier about Frank Lloyd Wright, and I remember that he had a proposal at one point to knock down all of the buildings of New York and make it into some kind of a green environment, and then put up 2-mile-high buildings that would take care of all the buildings and all the housing.
Right. Well, you know, I think because Manhattan has such a remarkable density and because it's so transformed, because you come to Midtown, for example, and it's all asphalt and tall buildings, it makes a person wonder what was here before and what's going to be here in the future. And so I've been working with the Van Allen Institute to work on a architectural competition idea where we would give away the Manhattan data to architects and urban planners and ask, if you were to build a city that was robust and as sustainable as Manhattan that might exist 400 years from now, Manhattan 2409, what would that city look like?
Have you gotten proposals? Like?
We're just about to announce the competition, so we're really looking forward to that.
Can you tell us about the MuirWeb software that you use and how it helped you understand the environment of the island?
Right. So we had to do something that I think is actually kind of new and innovative, which is, in order to figure out where all the species were and relate them to the map information we had to document their habitat relationships. And that meant we just went back to field guides like the ones you might have on your shelf and said, you know, this bird needs this and this fish needs this and this mammal needs this. And it turns out that that data, that kind of data, is like a social network, that you can configure it like a network. And so we call this network of habitat relationships, which is like food webs, but it's food webs plus shelter, plus water, plus reproductive resources. We call that a Muir web after John Muir, the naturalist, because John Muir said something which is one of my favorite quotes of all time, which is that if you grab any piece of nature and you tug on it, you find it connected by 1,000 invisible cords to everything else in nature.
If I had gone to Brooklyn or Queens or Staten Island actually was the first place people thought of inhabiting, would I have found something quite different?
Well, there would have been subtle differences, particularly on Staten Island. Staten Island is sort of the northern edge of a lot of the southern flora. Magnolias and a number of different butterflies and other small animals are found on Staten Island, but it would have been similar.
And it wasn't affected by the glacial changes. Manhattan was the bottom of that. The Bronx hills are because of all that glacial activity.
That's right, in the last glaciation. And the glaciation before that extended just to the northern edge of Long Island. But, you know, I think it's important to remember that there were people living on Staten Island for 8,000 years before the Europeans arrived. It would be a mistake to think of Manhattan or the New York City region in 1609 as an unpeopled landscape, because there were people here.
And Charles Mann, I think, wrote in 1491 that the landscape had already been affected by human habitation.
That's right. You know, human beings are a species just like any other species, and we affect other species through our activity. In fact,
sometimes negatively.
Well, in fact, that's a definition of what it means to be alive, right? I think what's different about human beings, of course, is we make choices about how we affect them. We're not evolutionary programmed to only make one kind of selection. We can actually make choices about how we want to live on the land.
Eric Sanderson will be speaking at the World Science Festival June 11th at 6:30. That's at the New York Historical Society. For more information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. There's the book, Manhattan, A Natural History of New York City, published by Abrams, and the exhibit that opens tomorrow at the Museum of the City of New York. And I thank you so much for being with us to talk about all of that.
Thank you, Leonard. I really appreciate it.